York City, the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, this is Democracy Now!
The number of deaths has more than doubled in the past week. In the next few days, we will reach 1 million confirmed cases and 50,000 deaths.
The coronavirus death toll has reached epic proportions. The United States is expected to see an even further surge in deaths in the coming weeks, even as the government's stockpile of medical supplies is nearly empty. Millions have lost their jobs. We'll speak with the head of Public Citizen about how President Trump's response has been to support drug manufacturers and suspend environmental rules. Then, how is the coronavirus impacting India and the global south?
What should I do? I had rations of food for 2 to 3 days. And even that will be finished by now. We will die of hunger. Earlier, we were dying from the coronavirus. Now we will die from hunger. Where do we go to earn a living?
We'll go to Bombay to speak with an Indian journalist who says social distancing is a privilege. And we'll speak with global health expert Yanis Ben-Amour. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, New York City. The coronavirus pandemic continues its relentless expansion in almost every corner of the globe, with the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases worldwide rapidly approaching 1 million people, though the true number is certain to be far higher due to a critical lack of testing. The largest number of confirmed cases is in the United States, where the coronavirus deaths have topped 5,000. Managers of the Strategic National Stockpile warn emergency supplies of medical equipment, including life-saving ventilators, are all but exhausted. The Intercept reports that even as the pandemic reached U.S. soil and began to spread, the Trump administration allowed a steady flow of ventilators and PPE, that's personal protective equipment supplies, to be sent abroad with a shipment as recently as March 17th. Meanwhile, all but the sickest patients and the wealthiest Americans continue to struggle to learn their COVID-19 status. One New Jersey lab, Quest Diagnostics, reported a backlog of about 160,000 COVID-19 tests, delaying some results by as much as 10 days. Here in New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, over 1,400 people have died. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo warned state residents Wednesday to expect a high death rate through July, through the summer, he said. Mayor Bill de Blasio has repeatedly warned city hospitals are in dire need of millions of masks, hundreds of thousands of gowns, and hundreds of ventilators, and could run out of supplies by April 5th. For many medical workers, the breaking point has already arrived. One New York City doctor tweeted a photo of the personal protective equipment she was handed when she arrived for her shift, a New York Yankees-branded rain poncho. Across the Hudson River, seven hospitals in New Jersey reached capacity Wednesday and were forced to divert COVID-19 patients to other hospitals. New Jersey's coronavirus death toll has topped 350, and New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy said Wednesday his state also faces critical shortages.
Do we have enough ventilators? No. Do we have enough PPE? No. Do we have enough beds? No. Do we have enough health care workers? No. Four emphatic no's.
In Georgia, where at least 154 people have died of COVID-19, Republican Governor Brian Kemp Wednesday told residents to prepare for a shelter-in-place order beginning Friday. Governor Kemp's announcement came weeks after medical professionals warned coronavirus infections would explode across Georgia without strict social distancing measures.
What we've been telling people from directives from the CDC for weeks now, that if you start feeling bad, stay home. Those individuals could have been infecting people before they ever felt bad. Well, we didn't know that until the last 24 hours. And as Dr. Toomey told me, she goes, this is a game changer.
In fact, a report in the New England Journal of Medicine published in late January warned asymptomatic people can spread the coronavirus, and the finding has informed public policy worldwide for weeks. The governors of Pennsylvania, Florida, and Mississippi issued stay-at-home directives Wednesday, while Alabama Governor Kay Ivey has refused to follow suit. Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis reportedly reversed his longstanding opposition to a statewide lockdown after a phone call from President Trump yesterday, though the president continues to refuse pleas by public health officials to issue a nationwide remain-at-home order. 11 states still have no such policy in place. House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff says he's consulting with other lawmakers on plans to form an independent commission to probe why the U.S. was so unprepared for the coronavirus pandemic. Schiff told The Washington Post the inquiry would be modeled after the 9/11 commission and should convene once the nation is back on its feet. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti Wednesday urged all residents to use non-medical grade masks or facial coverings while in public. The advice came as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is reconsidering its advisory that people should not wear masks, advice that was aimed at preventing a run on personal protective equipment, which is already in short supply. The White House has rejected calls to reopen health insurance exchanges under the Affordable Care Act ahead of the next open enrollment period in November. About half of Americans get their health insurance from their employer, and this week, Federal Reserve economists said a staggering 47 million U.S. workers could be laid off due to the pandemic. On Guam, the U.S. Navy will allow thousands of sailors to disembark from the USS Theodore Roosevelt to prevent the further spread of the coronavirus. Officials will keep a skeleton crew aboard the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. The evacuation came after the ship's captain wrote in an impassioned plea to naval commanders that, quote, sailors do not need to die. Acting U.S. Navy Secretary Thomas Modley on Wednesday did not rule out punishment for the captain over the letter's release.
I don't know who leaked the letter to the media. That would be something that would violate the principles of good order and discipline if he were responsible for that.
Legendary jazz pianist and composer Ellis Marsalis Jr. has died of complications from COVID-19 at the age of 85. Ellis Marsalis was one of New Orleans' best-loved musicians and the father of six sons, including the legendary jazz artist Branford and Wynton Marsalis. In Poughkeepsie, New York, Adam Schlesinger, co-founder of the rock band Fountains of Wayne, died Wednesday after a battle with COVID-19. Schlesinger won a Grammy Award in 2010 for a comedy collaboration with Stephen Colbert. He was nominated for an Academy Award and a Golden Globe for the soundtrack to the 1996 film That Thing You Do, and also won three Emmys. He co-wrote songs with Rachel Bloom. He was 52 years old. The White House's top medical expert on the coronavirus pandemic, Dr. Anthony Fauci, has reportedly been given a security detail after receiving death threats. Dr. Fauci has repeatedly contradicted Trump's false claims about the pandemic and the timeline for any new treatments or a vaccine. He's been pilloried in conservative media circles and language echoing President Trump. For example, a recent headline in the American Thinker referred to Fauci as a, quote, deep state Hillary Clinton-loving stooge. Meanwhile, in California, federal prosecutors have charged a locomotive driver who deliberately derailed a train Tuesday and crashed it near the U.S. Navy hospital ship Mercy, which is docked at the Port of Los Angeles to relieve the burden on hospitals strained by COVID-19 patients. 44-year-old driver Eduardo Moreno reportedly outlined a conspiracy theory to investigators alleging the ship was sent as part of a government takeover. In Guayaquil, the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic in Ecuador, bodies wrapped in plastic bags have been left decomposing in the streets and in empty buildings for days as hospitals are overwhelmed with COVID-19 patients and the city morgue lies full. Officially, Ecuador has the second most coronavirus cases in Latin America after Brazil, with over 2,700 reported cases and 98 deaths. But officials in Guayaquil say they've recovered over 400 bodies in recent days. In the Philippines, authoritarian President Rodrigo Duterte said Wednesday he's ordered soldiers to shoot to kill residents if they resist a strict lockdown on the island of Luzon.
I will not hesitate. My orders are sa police pati military, pati mga barangay.
Also with the village officials, if there are troubles or occasions where there's violence
at ang buhay ninyo
and your lives are in danger,
lagay sa alanganin, shoot them dead.
Duterte's order came after residents of Manila's Quezon City shantytown staged a protest saying they've gone hungry without food or relief supplies that were promised when the lockdown began more than 2 weeks ago. In Europe, COVID-19 continues its unrelenting death toll as hospitals across the continent were pushed past their breaking points. Spain's death toll topped 10,000, with a record 950 new deaths reported in a single day. In the UK, London's Excel Convention Center has been converted into an enormous field hospital with plans to treat up to 4,000 COVID-19 patients. Over 2,300 people have died from the disease across the UK, where the first time since World War II, the Wimbledon tennis tournament has been canceled. In Italy, COVID-19 deaths have topped 13,000, but the Wall Street Journal reports Italy's true toll is far higher because Italy cannot spare the resources to test every dead body. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence said Wednesday, models predict the United States faces a trajectory of COVID-19 deaths similar to Italy's. Back in the United States, a third prisoner has died of COVID-19 at the Oakdale Federal Prison in Louisiana. There are confirmed cases in prisons or ICE jails in Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, Arkansas, Pennsylvania, California, Nevada, Colorado, Minnesota, Ohio, Kentucky, Maryland, Vermont, and New Jersey, and in Illinois, where a 59-year-old prisoner died of COVID-19 at the Stateville prison near Joliet. In Detroit, a Michigan Department of Corrections officer died of COVID-19 Tuesday, and more than 140 prisoners have tested positive. Here in New York City, the top physician at the Rikers Island Jail said it's now unlikely officials will be able to halt the spread of COVID-19, predicting 20% of those infected will need hospitalization and 5% will require ventilators. Dr. Ross McDonald called the situation at Rikers a public health disaster unfolding before our eyes. Prisoners report they're packed 50 to a dorm, sleeping 15 inches apart with no access to soap, gloves, sanitizer, or bleach. The United States is the world's largest incarcerator by far, with 2.3 million people behind bars. Georgia Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler is facing fresh calls to resign over revelations her husband invested heavily in a medical supply company ahead of the stock market's coronavirus crash. Senator Loeffler's latest financial disclosures show her husband, Jeffrey Sprecher, who's chair of the New York Stock Exchange, bought more than $200,000 worth of shares of DuPont in late February and early March when Loeffler had access to privileged briefings about the threat of the coronavirus. DuPont produces personal protective equipment for medical workers. In February, Senator Loeffler and her husband began dumping millions of dollars worth of shares in companies that have since plummeted in value. At the time, Loeffler publicly downplayed the risk of a pandemic, tweeting, quote, "Democrats have dangerously and intentionally misled the American people on coronavirus readiness," unquote. Another Republican senator, Intelligence Committee Chair Richard Burr of North Carolina, faces a Senate ethics probe and an FBI investigation after he sold as much as $1.7 million worth of stocks just days before markets began tanking in February. The United Nations has indefinitely postponed the COP26 climate summit scheduled for Glasgow, Scotland in November over coronavirus fears. The Climate Action Network responded in a statement, quote, "Let us remember this pandemic is taking place against the backdrop of an ecological crisis, one that threatens the lives of millions of people and will exacerbate the risks we already face. Just like a fast-spreading virus, climate change has no regard for borders. If one country is not safe, no country is safe," they said. In Wisconsin, Democratic Governor Tony Evers has refused calls to cancel primary elections set for April 7th and will activate the Army National Guard to work at polling places despite an explosion in coronavirus cases and 25 deaths. In Milwaukee, election officials are set to invalidate more than 450 absentee ballots that were signed without a witness's signature, as required by law, despite statewide social distancing orders that have been in effect since March 24th. Vermont Senator, presidential candidate Bernie Sanders pleaded with Wisconsin to delay voting, writing, quote, "People should not be forced to put their lives on the line to vote," which is why 15 states are now following the advice of public health experts and delaying their elections, he said. This comes as at least three poll workers in Florida have tested positive for COVID-19 since Florida's March 17th primary, two in Broward County, one in Jacksonville. Meanwhile, Democratic frontrunner Joe Biden called Wednesday on the Democratic National Committee to delay its presidential nominating convention in Milwaukee from mid-July to August. And elected officials around the United States are demanding that President Trump and Republican lawmakers apologize for repeatedly calling the novel coronavirus the Chinese virus. Trump's repeated use of the term came as Asian Americans across the United States reported a rash of hate crimes, including a number of assaults on Asian New York City subway riders. This is New York State Senator John Liu.
We have this long legacy, not a great legacy, of being termed the yellow peril from over 100 years ago. And unfortunately, Trump calling this the Chinese virus only perpetuates this notion of yellow peril.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we will look at the economy. We will look at corporations getting exclusive rights to drugs. And we will look at the global South. This is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, New York City. Stay with us.
There is a bond in Gilead.
Nina Simone, and we're going to be speaking about a different Gilead in a moment, the Gilead Corporation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, joined by my colleague, my co-host, Nermeen Sheikh, who is joining us to protect community spread against community spread, joining us from her home in New York City. Hi, Nermeen. The coronavirus pandemic has now spread to more than 200 countries and regions. On Wednesday, the head of the World Health Organization, or WHO, predicted a death toll of epic proportions.
Over the past 5 weeks, we have witnessed a near exponential growth in the number of new cases, reaching almost every country, territory, and area. The number of deaths has more than doubled in the past week. In the next few days, we will reach 1 million confirmed cases and 50,000 deaths.
The United States has the most coronavirus cases in the world, almost double the next country. Nearly 2,400 people have died here in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, half the national total. More than 1,300 of those deaths were here in New York City. With the nation's healthcare system already stretched to capacity and protective gear in short supply, President Trump and his health advisors say more than 100,000 to 240,000 yes. Americans could die from the coronavirus over the next weeks. This is White House coronavirus coordinator Deborah Birx speaking on Tuesday.
Slope. So as mortality, the fatalities to this disease will increase, and then it will come back down, and it will come back down slower than the rate at which it went up. And so that is really the issue, how much we can push the mortality down.
This comes as millions of people have lost their jobs. Last week's unemployment claims saw the largest single-week increase in unemployment claims in American history, times five, with an estimated 3.3 million people filing for benefits. Another 5 million claims are expected to be filed this week. For more, we're joined by Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen, who's been following all of this very closely from his home in Washington, D.C., where he's joining us now, again from his home, where he can protect himself, his family, and stop community spread. Rob, I'm so glad to be talking to you, but not under these circumstances. Can you start off by just responding to the president this week for the first time, admitting the enormity of the crisis that we're in? The latest news, Li Feng of The Intercept writing that the U.S. was exporting military equipment as late as March 17th. President Trump now admitting we're talking about 100,000 to a quarter of a million Americans dead in the next weeks. Can you start off by just responding to this and then talking about the so-called stimulus bill that was passed? Nancy Pelosi saying they need a second one, and Mitch McConnell saying there's no way that's going to happen. Talk about the state of this country right now.
Well, thanks, Amy. It is great to be with you, and of course, not how we'd like to do it. You know, when it comes to Trump, we've called for him to resign as a clear and present danger to the public health of the country. You know, we support his impeachment, but this is a whole different thing. It's not hard to be a leader in times of crisis. It calls on you to do great things or even mediocre things. The script is pretty well written for you, but he can't follow it because he doesn't have empathy for other human beings. Everything that happens on the planet for him is about him. And as a result, we've had disastrous leadership. The utter failure of the government to take leadership in treating this as the wartime emergency that he says it is, you know, to make sure that we produce masks for people who need them. It is not a hard thing to do, to make sure we have ventilators for everyone who needs them. We did not have a proper stockpile, but we should have moved at a national wartime footing to move into production to get sufficient ventilators. We were able to do it in World War II 70 years ago. We're far more technologically advanced. It's crazy that it hasn't happened. And it hasn't happened because we don't have national leadership. We don't have a leader who is able to speak in terms of solidarity and bringing us together, even as we're isolated, which is exactly what we need right now. And we don't have a leader who's able to acknowledge the science and tell the truth. He's come around in the last few days, and hopefully he'll stay there. But his months-long failure to acknowledge what's going on obviously and clearly has set the nation on a far more deadly trajectory than it would otherwise be on. So it's hard to say enough bad things about how the president has handled this, and it didn't have to be. This is not about how progressive you are. You just have to be someone who understands what it is to be a leader in times of crisis, do the things that need to be done, and he is utterly incapable of doing that. Obviously, this has rocked the economy, and it's going to get worse and go on for we don't know how long. I think it's a mistake to only think about the worst-case scenarios, but the worst-case scenarios are certainly very frightening. The Congress has done some extraordinary things and some really pretty bad things in response. This last relief or stimulus bill that was just passed, called the CARES Act, was extraordinary to the extent of its size and the speed with which Congress acted. So it's a $2 trillion bill that will actually make available about $6 trillion to the economy. For a first cut, that's pretty good at scale. It does a lot of good things in terms of getting money out to states, getting monies out to hospitals, and having a very strong unemployment program. So as people are being thrown off their jobs, they're going to be able to get, apply for and get unemployment that will give them 100% of what they were making, at least for the next 4 months. There's a lot of bad stuff in that bill, too. It was pretty clear how it should have been structured. If there was a decision made that we need to keep businesses intact, which I think is a reasonable call, they need financing to get through this time because we want them to remain as going concerns and we want the economy to keep functioning. The number one thing we wanted out of them was to keep people on the payroll. And this program does not require businesses to keep people on the payroll as a condition of receiving government loans. It has some conditions that are included so that companies can't spend the money they get on dividend payments and stock buybacks. However, it permits the Treasury Secretary to waive those conditions if he sees fit, and we can't feel very good about how that's going to go.
Robert Weiss, as you mentioned, millions of people are unemployed. Millions more are expected to lose their jobs. And what is happening, the scale and the scope of these job losses are reportedly unprecedented in U.S. history. And to take just one example of the scale of the loss, the U.S. Travel Association has warned that the U.S. tourism industry will be, the loss to the U.S. tourism industry will be more than $900 billion, which is seven times what it was following 9/11. Meanwhile, many observers are drawing comparisons between what's likely to happen as a result of this and the Great Depression, not just the recession of 2008, but the Great Depression. What kind of response do you think could compensate for what millions and millions of Americans are going to suffer in the long term?
Right. Well, there is no parallel to this in terms of the scope and that it affecting every single person in the United States and every single person around the world. We are, in fact, shutting down huge portions of the economy. So it's different than the Great Depression or even the Great Recession. Market or the system's not working. We've got an external problem and we're making an intentional, appropriate, and necessary decision to shut down economic activity. The only force that can solve that problem is the government. This first stimulus bill is a partial response. But obviously, when you have a total problem, you really need a total solution. I'm starting with people who are the most vulnerable, have the least possible cushion. So providing unemployment insurance is great. It doesn't adequately deal with the problem of all kinds of people who've been outside of the workforce all along, but we're able to get by one way or another and who are not likely to be able to get unemployment insurance. It doesn't take care of the issues you're raising about prisoners and other super vulnerable segments of society. We've got a massive population of immigrants and especially people who are undocumented who are going to have a lot of trouble accessing some of the financial supports that are available. And people are going to fall through the cracks. So we got to get more money out and we need protections for people to be able to stay in their homes. The bill that passed does a lot for people who are homeowners to help give them some break on mortgage payments. It doesn't adequately deal with renters who are obviously generally going to be lower income than the class of mortgage payers. A lot of localities and states are trying to address the rent problem, but not all of them. So a lot of people are going to be really stuck unless we have much stronger moves forward to protect all people.
Rob, I want to ask you about Gilead. Facing mounting pressure from elected officials and dozens of groups, including yours, Public Citizen, Gilead scientists backed down from holding on to the exclusive status the Trump administration granted it for a drug it's developing to treat COVID-19. Joe Grogan, a member of Trump's coronavirus task force, worked as a Gilead Sciences lobbyist from 2011 to 2017. The status would have allowed the corporation to profit exclusively off the drug for 7 years and blocked manufacturers from developing generic versions that can be more accessible to patients and control the drug's price. Senator Bernie Sanders tweeted, quote, "It's truly outrageous that after taxpayers put tens of millions of dollars into developing remdesivir, Trump's FDA is exploiting a law reserved for rare diseases to privatize a drug to treat a pandemic virus. The Trump administration must rescind this corporate giveaway to Gilead and make any treatment and vaccine free for everybody." Again, that was presidential candidate Bernie Sanders' statement. But can you explain what this whole controversy is about? What the role of Trump's, one of his top advisors, his domestic security advisor, Grogan, is now and was as a Gilead lobbyist?
Yeah, this is extraordinary. So Gilead has one of the possible treatments under study. So this is not a vaccine. The treatment very well may not work, but it's one of the ones that has the best promise among a not very good group. So what Gilead did was it sought protection, what's called orphan drug status, which is available for rare diseases, for drugs that treat populations of under 200,000. And they submitted their application for this rare disease status when there were fewer than 200,000 identified cases of COVID-19 in the United States. Obviously, they knew the population was going to go far higher than that, but they got in under the wire. And the way the law is written, not taking into account a situation like this, if you apply when the population is under 200,000, you get this orphan drug designation, whether or not the population later on goes above 200,000. It was astounding. What you get for orphan drug designation is a seven-year exclusivity, a monopoly that's separate from and in some ways more powerful than a patent monopoly. So we and others protested that. They quickly backed down because there's just no way they're going to be able to get away with that. They still have patents and other monopolies. So if the drug turns out to be useful, they will have a monopoly unless we impose more pressure on them or the government takes action to override the monopoly and ensure that other generic producers are able to get the drug on the market in the United States and around the world. The last element of this, which is so important, and it applies to this product and most of the vaccine efforts that are underway, and Senator Sanders' tweet points this out. This drug has benefited from a huge amount of government funding on the research and development side. The vaccines have been overwhelmingly researched. The development is overwhelmingly provided by the U.S. federal government. So in the case of Gilead, it was trying to receive this special grant of exclusivity from the U.S. government for a product that the U.S. government had actually paid for most of the R&D on. And we're facing the same possibility with a vaccine if we get one anytime soon.
And can you talk about the effect of this drug, not only in this country and around the world, the bigger issue of how countries get access to drugs and the role of this domestic security advisor? I mean, talking about the revolving door of who gets money and who doesn't, who gets drugs, in other words, life and death issues.
Right. So in terms of the revolving door issue, we have, you know, President Trump ran on the idea that he was going to take it to the drug companies because he was a tough guy. He's done nothing. Well, one reason he's done nothing is he's got drug company executives and lobbyists running his policy. So he's got Joe Grogan, as you say, formerly chief lobbyist for Gilead, running policy on drug pricing out of the White House. And he has a former drug company executive, Alex Azar, running the Department of Health and Human Services. So it's little surprise these are the kind of policies we're getting. When it comes to the vaccines, which are more important than this product from Gilead, which very well may not work, you know, eventually we're going to get a vaccine that works. The question is going to be, how is it made available? So is it exclusively controlled by one manufacturer that can charge us whatever it wants? Or is the government going to say, no, not only do we pay for this, but this is a public health, an international public health emergency with no parallel. You'll get some money, but we're going to make this available to everyone around the world. Hopefully no one has to pay for it. But the payment to the drug company or companies from the government will be modified in light of the fact that the government paid for the R&D, and we're going to require any company that might have monopoly control over it to license that product to other qualified manufacturers around the world. Because we're going to have a problem not just with price, but with production. Once we have a vaccine that works, we want it available to everybody around the world right away. And there is no manufacturer who's got anything like the capacity to be able to do that. So we need lots of producers right away, including, in fact, we need the U.S. government to start scaling up production to do it at the scale we need for this one-time international emergency.
Last Thursday, the Environmental Protection Agency announced sweeping and indefinite suspension of environmental rules, telling companies they'll effectively be allowed to regulate themselves during the coronavirus pandemic. Under the new rules, big polluters will no longer be punished for failing to comply with reporting rules and other requirements. The EPA has set no end date for the policy. Then on Tuesday, the EPA announced a rollback of an Obama rule that forced auto manufacturers to produce more fuel-efficient vehicles. Under the new rules, big polluters will no longer be punished for failing to comply with reporting rules and other requirements. Meanwhile, Trump says he's invited U.S. oil executives to the White House to discuss how he can help their devastated industry. And protests against pipelines are being further decriminalized at this time as a threat to national security. Before we wrap up, Rob, if you can address this critical issue, the largest rollback we've seen of environmental rules in history.
Yeah, just startling. It's another revolving door story. We have a coal lobbyist who's running the Environmental Protection Agency, and he said, we're not going to enforce the rules right now. It's framed as a reporting requirement, but effectively means that pollution rules are not going to be enforced. For no good reason. The argument is that people are too busy and stretched to do reporting. Doesn't really hold up under any kind of scrutiny. And it means that for those producers who are still making stuff, they're going to be putting a lot more toxic materials into the water and into the air. Now, a separate thing is this rollback of the Clean Car Standard, which you mentioned. That is the most important climate change initiative that the United States government has ever undertaken by far. It would both reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions from automobiles, and it would save consumers hundreds of billions of dollars in reduced payments at the pump. The Trump administration has sought from the beginning to roll this back, and they thought fit to do it now under the cover of the COVID crisis. It is an utter disgrace, and it will have very long-lasting implications unless it itself is undone, which I think it will be either in the courts or by a next president.
And at the same time, you have the UN Climate Summit being canceled in Glasgow, in Scotland, because of the coronavirus pandemic.
Right. You know, one thing we're seeing from this is, of course, this has no parallel, but there are some similarities with what we're going to deal with the climate catastrophe that's coming at us and the need for government to step in. There is no way for private corporations to deal with this crisis right now. They can't manage the economy. They can't make planning and management decisions that require some overview of what's going on. Only the federal government can do that. And it is exactly the same with the climate crisis. And when we come out of this, in fact, when we look at the next stimulus bill, we're going to have to start talking about thinking not just how we deal with this immediate crisis, but how we now finally, belatedly, take scaled up action to prevent the climate crisis from hitting us even harder and more devastatingly than this one is.
We want to thank you so much, Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen, joining us from his home to protect against community spread. I hope you'll bear with the little glitches of sound and video. This is the price that's paid to get out serious, real, independent information in a time of a pandemic. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at the Global South. We will start in India, the largest lockdown of a population in U.S. history. Stay with us.
Slow down. There's gonna be trouble. You're gonna forget what you do. One false move, baby, suddenly everything's ruined. You're gonna be sorry. You're gonna regret what you're doing. One false move, baby, suddenly everything's ruined. And you ought to know, you ought to know, there's only one way this can go. You ought to know, you ought to know, all of the ups and downs, the highs and lows.
Everything's Ruined by Fountain of Wayne. The band's co-founder, Adam Schlesinger, died on Wednesday after a battle with COVID-19. He was 52 years old. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're broadcasting from the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States in New York City. But we're turning now to India, where 1.3 billion people have been locked down for more than a week to curb the spread of the coronavirus. India is now reporting nearly 2,000 cases and at least 50 deaths. Prime Minister Narendra Modi apologized Sunday for the devastation India's 21-day curfew has wrought for millions of people living in poverty and migrant workers who were stranded far from home when the lockdown was announced. Some have reportedly died making the perilous journey home. Last week, Modi's government announced a $22.6 billion stimulus plan to provide cash payments and food to people in need. More than 80% of India's workforce is informal, with most living off daily wages, often less than $2 or $3 a day. Wages they cannot earn under the present curfew. More than 4 million Indians are homeless. One homeless man in Delhi told Reuters, quote, "I would rather die from disease than hunger," as he joined dozens of others forced to congregate on the streets for free food distribution. Millions more of India's poor have been devastated by the lockdown. This is Ahid Ali, who lives in a slum in the country's capital, New Delhi.
Everybody is disturbed here. Children of many people are sick, but they do not have the money or the means to take them to the hospital. No rickshaw, no vehicle, nothing. When they return to their houses, there is no food. So what will one do? And what will one eat? This is hopeless. It is better altogether to just kill people.
Well, for more, we're joined by the Indian journalist Rana Ayub. She's global opinions writer for The Washington Post. Her recent piece in Foreign Policy is headlined, "Social Distancing is a Privilege." Rana, welcome back to Democracy Now! Tell us where you are in India, and can you describe the situation there now?
Well, Amy, great to be joining the show again. I'm in Mumbai, and I've been reporting from the city, especially from Dharavi, one of Asia's largest slums with a population of close to 1 million people in one square mile. And yesterday, we had our first COVID-related death in the slum. And I can only imagine the consequences of this. I was there about 5 days ago in Dharavi, where even talking about the concept of social distancing seems like an obscene concept, because here we have close to 7 people living in one shanty with absolutely no access to water, soap, sanitation. How do you talk to them about social distancing and cleanliness and hygiene? And the people who live there earn not more than about $2 a day, daily wage workers, hand-to-mouth existence. You rightly pointed out that many of them say that they would rather die of the disease than of this hunger that has now been inflicted on them, because the government announced a lockdown on the 24th of March at 8 p.m. in the evening, and that has only led to chaos. The visuals that you see, not just in Bombay but across the country, are migrant laborers, workers traveling all the way from the cities to their hometowns, traveling thousands of kilometers, some with children on their backs, starving, without footwear. I mean, it's not a sight to behold. And right now, where I am in Bombay, another 80 people have been quarantined in a separate slum. So, yes, like I wrote in my piece, social distancing is a privilege in India because there is a structural divide. The privileged people in India who, you know, have already stocked the refrigerators, they have hand sanitizers, but the underprivileged, which is about 60% of this country, cannot afford this, cannot afford social distancing. Amy?
Yes, yeah, Amy.
Rana, I mean, as you just mentioned, the lockdown that Modi imposed at 8 p.m. Last week led to this mass migration from cities to rural areas. And as you write in your foreign policy piece, when the lockdown began, a 32-year-old man was beaten to death by cops West Bengal when he stepped out to buy milk. Could you talk about that as well as the other kinds of police brutality that migrants have been subjected to, including being sprayed with a bleach disinfectant?
That's right, Nermeen. About close to 5 days ago, just about 2 days after the lockdown was announced, a man who stepped out of his house to buy milk for his children was brutally beaten by the police, and he died. Once he reached home. There are many who were subjected to police brutality all over the country, especially migrant laborers. Some laborers who were on the way from the city to the village were sprayed with disinfectants and bleach. Now, this is such a contradiction from the upper middle class Indians who were literally airlifted from various countries and flown into India, and they were checked in, and the poor were sprayed. They sprayed bleach on them. So there is a disparity. There's a differential treatment between the rich and the poor. I mean, look at the government hospitals in India where the poor will now go for the treatment. The WHO recommends that India needs to have one doctor to every 1,000 patients. We have one doctor to 10,000 patients. So we have a million problems right now plaguing us, and the police brutality and the insensitivity. And the insensitivity of the Indian state. Of course, it announced lockdown, and that was perhaps the only solution that India could afford right now in a situation like this. But I think India could have done a lot better. For instance, the first COVID case in India was diagnosed on the 31st of January, and India took a month and a half to declare a health emergency on the 15th of March. Between this time, India was hosting Donald Trump, and millions of rupees were spent on this entire Trump, Modi, Bonhomie, and the various programs. In the middle, India was dominating international headlines for the anti-Muslim carnage in New Delhi, while in neighborhood China, they were already fighting the virus. So India woke up to this pandemic a little too late, and we are staring at a grim future. Also, to be fair to the government now, they are taking much needed steps. It's a little too late, though, in the day.
And Rana, could you talk a little bit more about the health, broader health issues in India? You point this out also in your piece in Foreign Policy, that India spends just 3.7% of its GDP on health. And just by way of comparison, the U.S. spends 17% of its GDP on health. And yet we've seen how devastating the situation is in the U.S. in terms of its response to COVID-19. So that's one issue. And the second is that only one-fifth of deaths in India are even recorded, including with causes. So it might be even in the future very difficult to say how many people in India have died from COVID-19.
Absolutely, Nermeen, you're right, because India has seen millions of cases of respiratory diseases. It is home to some of the highest cases of diabetes and hypertension. Tuberculosis is something thousands of Indians die due to tuberculosis, and and the fact that we have still not ramped up our healthcare. I mean, as of today, India has tested only about 35,000 people in a country of 1.3 billion population, which means India is not testing enough. Like various epidemiologists have suggested and various doctors and healthcare specialists in India have suggested, that it would be impossible to gauge whether Indians are dying of respiratory diseases or COVID-related symptoms because, one, we're not testing enough, and second, our healthcare system is not is not good enough to have taken care of the diseases that mostly plague the underprivileged in this country. So that's something that we really need to look at because I mean while the country was facing some of its worst healthcare problems, the government of India has had different priorities. It was spending billions of rupees constructing statues of Lord Ram in Uttar Pradesh, where children are dying of encephalitis and there are no oxygen cylinders in the hospital. In Gujarat, where the tallest statue of Sardar Patel was constructed in a show of jingoism and nationalism. So throughout this show of nationalism, when the government was spending billions of rupees on statues, which was not needed, India could have spent the same amount of money on its healthcare when 1.3 billion people of your population, and out of it 60%, lives below the poverty line. You cannot afford to be insensitive to a prospective pandemic like this, which has now hit us. And we are in a very bad shape as I talk, Nermeen.
We want to thank you, Rana Ayoob, for joining us. Rana Ayoob is an Indian journalist, global opinions writer for The Washington Post, author of Gujarat Files, Anatomy of a Cover-Up. Her recent piece in Foreign Policy is headlined, Social Distancing is a Privilege. We will link to that article in Foreign Policy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our coronavirus special every day right now as we broadcast from the epicenter of the pandemic in the United States, right here in New York City. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're going to end the hour by continuing to look at the growing threat the pandemic poses to the Global South. Monday, the United Nations warned the pandemic is poised to devastate fragile economies and poorer nations, estimating more than $220 billion of income will be lost as the virus spreads, a blow that could decimate food security, education and human rights. Billions of people from Africa to Latin America to South Asia and elsewhere work in the informal economy, leaving them particularly vulnerable to the global economic crisis that COVID-19 has sparked. The virus is also expected to overwhelm weak health systems and worsen the already stark divide between rich and poor. To talk more about this, we go to Yanis Ben-Amor, assistant professor of global health and microbiological sciences at Columbia University, executive director of the Center for Sustainable Development at the Earth Institute. If you could give us a global picture, professor, of what we're seeing right now in the global south. At this point, the numbers do not compare to what we're seeing, for example, in the United States, the epicenter. Now, here the testing is terrible, the access to testing. And there is that divide between rich and poor. But in the global south, are we not seeing numbers because of almost complete lack of access to tests, or are there other reasons?
First of all, good morning, and thank you for having me on your show. So I would see that there's two reasons why there seems to be a delay in what's happening in Africa. Apologies for the sound. I am taking the call from home. So first of all, it seems that the coronavirus pandemic has hit the world in successive waves. Obviously, it started in Wuhan, China, and it is possible that Chinese Americans, Chinese Italians, Chinese French, who were in China for the New Year or the Chinese New Year, ended up coming back with the infection, or Americans, French, Italians, Spaniards who were in China for the New Year ended up bringing the infection back into Europe, into America, and starting a second wave. We are now seeing a third wave hitting Africa and India, possibly because of European tourism or American tourism into India and into Africa. In fact, the first case in Nigeria was linked to an Italian tourist. So I would say that one of the reasons why there seem to be less cases in Africa and in India is because of a delay. In fact, Italy was behind China. We in the United States are considered to be 10 days behind Europe, and Africa may be 10 to 15 days behind us. But what you mentioned is also true. We are not testing enough people in the United States. They are not testing enough people in Europe. It is impossible to imagine that the numbers that are reported by WHO every day are an accurate depiction of what's actually going on. At the beginning of the crisis, let's say a month ago, the Africa CDC said that only 4 out of the 54 countries in Africa would be able to diagnose coronavirus. Now we're in a much better situation. 46 out of the 54 countries have the equipment to test. But do they have the tests? They don't. And I am talking to colleagues across Africa, whether it's in Nairobi or in Accra or in Johannesburg, and they're suffering the same problems that we have in the United States. There aren't enough tests.
On the other hand, Yanis Ben-Amor, you've also suggested that because of Ebola, certain countries in Africa may be better prepared to deal with an epidemic or indeed a pandemic like COVID-19. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. So I would say that the situation in Africa is still a little bit mysterious as to how it's going to unfold. And I'm going to explain why there are 2 positive trends and 3 negative trends, and no expert can really predict. So it seems that the African continent has been preparing for outbreaks, for epidemics, for many years. In 2014, 2015, there was the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone, in Guinea, and Liberia, and a lot of the African countries, neighboring, but also continent-wide, prepared for sentinel systems to make sure that they would be able to detect their first Ebola cases and that they would put in place systems so that whenever they had a case, they would put them in quarantine and they would do contact tracing, which is whenever you have a case, you go around and you see any person that has been in contact, and then you also put them in quarantine. This was effectively done with SARS back in 2002 and 2003. That was a lot easier with SARS because everybody who was infectious was symptomatic. And that is not the case with this coronavirus, with SARS-CoV-2, because the infectiousness seems to be starting 48 hours to 24 hours before the apparition of symptoms. And in fact, many, many cases are even considered to be asymptomatic. So they are spreading the infection without knowing it. So the African continent has been preparing for an outbreak. So in theory, they have the systems in place. But as I told earlier, they need to have the diagnostic test. So they would be able to run the tests. But if the tests are not available, just like in the best hospital in New York City, you are not able to distinguish who has a regular flu, who has a pneumonia, from who has coronavirus. So Africa has another interesting advantage.
We just have 30 seconds, Yanis.
Sorry. So Africa has a very young population. So it's very difficult to see how the disease will evolve. The median age in Africa is about 20 years compared to China, which is about 40, or in Europe, which is about 45. So we know that the disease affects young people a lot less. The problems are there are many other diseases like HIV, malaria, tuberculosis, malnutrition, and they're going to negatively impact. Social distancing, as was discussed by your previous contributor, social distancing is not going to be possible. It's going to be possible for the urban rich, but not for the majority of the population.
Yanis Ben-Amor, we thank you so much for being with us, Assistant Professor of Global Health and Microbiological Sciences at Columbia University, Executive Director of the Center for Sustainable Development at the Earth Institute. And that does it for our show. These numbers have just come in. We just gotten the record number on unemployment. U.S. unemployment claims have hit 6.6 million, another record high as layoffs continue amidst the pandemic. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh from New York City. Thanks so much.